This podcast is not legal advice and should not be relied upon as such. You should always obtain legal advice about your specific circumstances.
Well, hello and welcome to our Smarter Lawcast podcast series on being ESG wise. My name is Meg Lee and I'm the co-lead of Hall & Wilcox's Environmental, Social and Governance Industry Group. I'd like to start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land from which I'm speaking today, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and pay respects to elders past, present and emerging, and to any Indigenous people listening to this podcast. Today, I'm delighted to welcome our guest, Neil Pearson, who is a partner and head of ESG at Mills & Reeve, a law firm based in London with offices around the UK and a law firm friend of Hall & Wilcox. Welcome, Neil. Great to have you with us.
Hi, yeah, great to be here. Thanks.
Well, today we're going to be discussing ESG trends with Neil giving us some insights into what's happening in the UK courts, where there have been some interesting recent developments on both government and board duties of care to respond to the climate crisis. These include two cases we thought it would be great to get Neil's insights on. The first is the case last year against the UK government itself about its climate policy and whether or not it was adequate and whether or not they were doing enough to implement it, I guess, is more the point. And the second case is a very new case lodged against the Shell board, where an environmental group is arguing that Shell directors are in breach of their duties to manage climate risk facing the company. So, Neil, I thought we would start by getting you to set the scene in the UK. Can you tell us a bit about the case against the UK government to start with?
Yeah, sure. The case in question goes back to a piece of legislation that was brought into the UK in 2008, the Climate Change Act, which was effectively a self-imposed obligation in which Parliament imposed on itself the obligation to set what they described as carbon budgets, what we would call reduction targets in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. And once those budgets were set, there's an obligation to prepare policies and strategies that will enable us to meet those targets, and also an obligation to report those proposals back to the UK Parliament for approval. And it started off with a very modest 2050 target in terms of carbon reduction, but it required a series every 5 years, it required a new carbon budget to be set for the following 5 year period, which worked fine until in June 21, the government published its most recent policy or budget, which was actually quite aggressive. It brought forward by 13 years the target to reduce emissions by 80% from the levels in the late 90s. And it was approved by the Secretary of State and laid before Parliament as the legislation requires in October of 21. But the difficulty was that as far as a lot of kind of climate activists and various civil organisations in UK society were concerned, there just wasn't enough flesh on the bones. It was a very admirable target to set, no question. Nobody questioned that. But the case revolved around the fact that the government was required under the legislation to set policies and targets, but actually to go into detail as to how the policies would actually help us achieve those targets. And ultimately, the government lost in court. They didn't lose on every count, but they lost in court on the basis that, quite frankly, there just wasn't enough detail. The Secretary of State, who'd approved the plan, had not put any detail in terms of how each individual policy would quantitatively reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the UK, and therefore was held to fall short of what the legislation actually required them to do. There was no quantitative assessment of each individual policy's impact and the way it would actually achieve what it was set out to do. So, in effect, the result of the judgment was the government was told to go away and redo its homework, in effect.
Yeah. Oh, it's such an interesting approach. So who was the litigant that brought the case?
It was an organisation, Climate Earth, Friends of the Earth were involved, and various other individuals. I guess any individual citizen in the UK can bring an action if it believes that the UK government hasn't actually complied with its own
keeping
kind
them
of
to
rules.
Account.
Yeah, basically.
Very interesting. And so am I right that it was that the way that they ran the case, they sort of showed that the the policies might lead to a certain percentage reduction, and but that that wasn't the 100% that was required. So they sort of, the litigants did a bit of analysis themselves on the impact of the policies.
They did. They there was a slight hole in the policies themselves, in which I'm not an expert on the actual technical detail of what the policies set out to achieve, but my understanding from reading the case was that first of all there was a gap. There was about a 5% gap in terms of the total emissions it was seeking to address. The court actually said that wasn't the fundamental problem. They didn't see in the legislation itself an obligation to absolutely square that one off. For them, the issue was around the fact
the strategies.
Setting out policies by themselves was all well and good, but where was the assessment that said each of the policies that were being put to Parliament for approval would actually have the impact that was desired? And so what in effect happened was the policies themselves were presented to Parliament for approval, but not the substance behind it that would enable Parliament to actually assess whether they should be approving the policies or not. And the idea is nobody was challenging the overall targets. Nobody was challenging the so-called carbon budgets within that five-year plan that was published in 21. And nobody was asking the court to quash the overarching strategy that the government had developed in its five-year plan. As I said, it was actually bringing forward by 13 years that the 80% target that had previously been set for 50-50 and was being accelerated through to 2037. So nobody had a question about that. The question was about the fact that
they didn't know how they were going to get there.
It's kind of mother and apple pie stuff. We all want it to happen, no question. But it's not enough to just say we're going to do these things. It really should be a question of, well, Parliament should be approving the strategy, because here's the quality of assessment that tells us how each of the individual policies being put forward would genuinely impact in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
Well, it's a real cautionary tale for us here in Australia, because we passed our Climate Change Act last year and we've got a similar regime of requirements to present annual progress reports towards how we're achieving our nationally determined contributions. So I think it's very analogous that someone like Client Earth could bring a case here in Australia on the very same basis.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that any government or any public authority that actually holds itself to account in the way that certainly the Climate Change Act in the UK does, and sounds like the legislation in Australia does as well, there's no question that somebody will hold the legislators to account.
Yeah.
If they set their own rules, they will be held to account for it. And also, there are examples in many other jurisdictions where this is happening. The UK is not exactly alone, and there has been a history in the UK of the government being challenged when it was felt that it was either exceeding its authority or not carrying out its mandate in a way that was compliant. There have been quite a few well-publicised cases relatively recently of it happening in other areas, but for climate change, it's a pretty obvious area in which there will be a lot of active civic societies looking at it in a great deal of detail.
So we've really moved on, haven't we, from governments not doing enough and people complaining that we haven't set targets. Well, certainly that was the case in Australia until very recently when we finally sort of signed on. So moving to sort of how you implement it, not just whether you're implementing it. So it sort of feels like we've moved on.
Absolutely. These types of legislation, they typically describe as framework legislation to self-evidently set the framework by which we will achieve some kind of progress towards the Paris targets. But it's not enough to just set targets and say, wouldn't it be great if we did this by this date? What this legislation forces governments to do is actually spend a lot more time doing their homework, a lot more time doing qualitative assessments to demonstrate why their policies are the right policies to adopt. Because without those qualitative assessments, it's almost impossible to actually judge whether they're right or not, to judge whether they will actually achieve what they're intended to achieve. So, as I say, the really curious fact is nobody for a second was challenging the government's overall intention here. which quite often is the case when governments are challenged.
Yeah.
You know, there are policies under attack in the courts from government where it is the policy itself that is under attack. Here, nobody's attacking the fact that we should be reducing greenhouse gases as quickly as possible. It's the way in which the government's choosing to go about it that is under attack, which is quite novel, I think, in terms of an attack on certainly in the UK.
Well, I think those green groups are getting very sophisticated in the way that they're bringing these cases and doing their own homework about how policies can have an effect and what policies, you know, should be implemented by governments. And I guess moving on to the corporate sector. Can you tell us a bit about the recent case that is it the same? I think it's Client Earth is again lodging the case against the Shell directors.
Yes. Client Earth are kind of driving the case forward. But this is a fascinating case for me. I mean, you talk about the ways in which climate activist groups and various civic organisations are looking to hold both private and public sector organisations to account. But this is a very clever way in which lawyers, rather than wait for regulators to come up with new rules that will enable us to police what's happening, they're taking what in effect is a very, very old rule. Shell are being sued under the UK Companies Act.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is a basic, and I'm sure this is the case across many jurisdictions, the Companies Act obviously sets out the basic duties of directors in terms of how they run and regulate companies. And there are two sections in particular which are relevant to this case, section 172, which places a basic obligation on directors to promote the success of their company, and section 174, which says that as they're doing that, they have to exercise reasonable care, skill and diligence in the way in which they go about.
Very similar to what we have here. Yeah.
And it's been, you know, when I was at law school, it was the Companies Act 1948 that was in play, and then it was the 1985 Act, and now it's the 2006 Act. But this has been here since
duties
companies legislation.
Changed.
Absolutely. So this is a very, very old and established principle in terms of how directors should behave. And basically, Shell, very well publicised, were taken to court, in fact, in the Netherlands, around their carbon strategy and the transition, which obviously fossil fuel companies will at some point have to go through and are going through now. And they were held to account in terms of how quickly they were looking to transition. And they were required by the Dutch courts to do more, quite honestly. And this is kind of following on from that. The question is, well, how quickly should they be moving? And in essence, what's happening is that the litigants here are basically saying that the targets that Shell have come up with in terms of their strategy for transition just aren't anywhere near good enough.
Right.
But they're not arguing it from an environmental law perspective. Their argument is fundamentally that the transition strategy in itself isn't good enough, isn't quick enough in terms of the targets. But more importantly, a series of targets that have been set, particularly around 2030, have completely excluded so-called scope 3 emissions, i.e. the indirect emissions for which they as a company are responsible. So in other words, the targets that they've developed in effect address, according to the litigants, only about 10% of the total emissions for which they believe Shell are responsible. And so their argument is that the directors are just in breach of those two basic duties that I mentioned. And the reason that they are in breach of those duties, according to the court papers, is that the company itself is subject to a material number of climate-related risks, which the current strategy simply fails to address adequately, from the physical impacts of climate crisis on their operations through to the effects of energy transition in wider society, both UK and global, through the increased likelihood of litigation, ironic in this case, but nevertheless, it's pretty obvious that there will be more of it. Increased regulatory focus, you know, there is absolutely no doubt the direction of travel is one way in terms of the regulators and the way in which they require disclosure and focus on this as an issue. Increased costs of access to capital, you know, that's fundamental to any business. And so what the litigants here are arguing is not breach of environmental legislation. They're saying that a failure to take account of material climate-related risks, in fact, risks this company or this group of companies being left with a huge bunch of stranded assets, which have a decades-long operating lives, but which will become useless because of the way in which these climate-related risks could hit the organization. In other words, it would lead to potentially massive write-downs, which would lead to massive losses, which would lead to massive depletion in shareholder value. And they're bringing this action in their capacity as shareholders. They're not bringing this action in their capacity as, you know, custodians of the planet, or you know, in terms of policing environmental legislation across the globe or trying to enforce the Paris Treaty. They're bringing this action as shareholders because they're saying that the board's failure to act, and their argument is the board's value. Their board's breach of duties comes down to basically putting the financial viability of the company at risk, which is not in the interests of shareholders. Which is a fascinating argument. They've completely sidestepped whether environmentally there are rules being broken, or whether it's a good or a bad thing to conduct, you know, exploitation of fossil fuels. Their argument is simple. This is all about financial viability in the long term. And the transition simply, according to them, has to happen a lot quicker. And it has to be a lot more thorough in terms of addressing the scope 3 emissions, as well as the scope 1 and 2 emissions, which the current policies do.
So there's no law they're saying that they've breached in the UK that requires them to address scope 3 at this stage?
Absolutely not. No, there is, ironically, very recently, there has just been published a potential piece of greenwashing litigation against them in terms of the disclosures of their transition policies. But that's entirely separate from this. And that's not being brought by the same litigants. This is all about a basic breach of directors' duties for failure to promote the success of the company in the long term, for taking actions which they believe will deplete shareholder value. It's all about economics, not about environment in that sense. And I think the other fascinating aspect of this case, which quite frankly has really set alarm bells ringing in a lot of boardrooms, is the fact that this is an action personally against the individuals.
I was about to ask you about that. So the remedies against the individuals are what? What are they seeking?
the legislation itself is entirely silent on what the remedies are. What they're actually seeking is a direction from the court. Although we haven't actually seen the papers yet, but they're actually seeking, my guess is they're seeking direction from the court, telling the directors they've got to do this better and quicker. I don't think they're seeking to sue the directors for millions of pounds of damages, because
it's not a damages.
You know, financial damages are not really the appropriate remedy here. This is about acting. But if you look, there was a case in the US involving Exxon, I think, where a shareholder, a group of shareholders, took a similar stance that Exxon wasn't transitioning quick enough away from fossil fuels. And they won the right to put, I think it was 3 directors onto the board to actually direct board policy towards transition quicker and better, as far as they were concerned. So you can see an analogy where the UK courts, they could tell the board to go away and just come back, a bit like they've told the UK government to go away and come back. They could tell the board to go away and come back with something that actually fits the bill, that meets the shareholders' requirements. They could, I guess, give shareholders who have these concerns the right to appoint directors onto the board. It's going to be a fascinating case, but the fact that the action was brought against the individuals personally, quite honestly, as I'm sure you will know, as a litigator, the moment liability becomes personal, board members will sit up and take note, in a way that they may not do if it was just against the company, quite frankly.
Absolutely.
It's a great way of getting people to sit up and listen. A really clever tactic.
A very clever tactic, I guess there's been some analogous cases here in the sense of shareholder action, derivative actions in Australia. And really it's a great way for shareholders to sort of at least start to get further information out of the companies by doing that sort of discovery process to start with, to see whether there's a reasonable basis for bringing an action. So some of the cases in Australia so far haven't got to that next stage of the actual action. It's been seeking the documents and then asking for more documents when they get the first round of disclosure. So it's sort of it's a very interesting sort of way of shareholders really starting to get into the operations of the company.
Well, I think, and certainly under the UK Companies Act, the ability to bring a derivative action, there is quite a high bar set in order to persuade the courts that you can do it, higher than I think in quite a lot of other jurisdictions. So the fact that the courts have actually said, yes, you can bring the action,
Was there indicative. Some prelude sort of steps to that in terms of seeking the information like I'm talking about in the Australian cases?
It's been rumbling on for a while. I mean, Climate Earth announced, I can't remember, spring last year, that they were going to be bringing this action. And they, I mean, you can go onto their website and see they put a slide deck together where they went out to other shareholders and started to explain what they thought the action should consist of and why, and what their concerns were. So it's been rumbling on for a while. But the fact that they actually got the court to agree they could bring the action meant that they got over quite a high hurdle to kind of begin with. And obviously Shell as an organization is subject to disclosure rules, which mean there is a lot of information in the public domain. There has to be. I mean, it's one of the strategies of the regulator if you force companies to disclose. And in the UK, we've just seen an extension of the disclosure rules to a wider variety of companies. So if you force companies to disclose and explain what they're doing, then you immediately allow a spotlight to be shined on what they're doing, and that enables scrutiny and that enables challenge. So I think there is a lot of information already out there that Climate Earth have used and other shareholders have used to bring this action.
Yeah, I mean, it does astound me that they haven't started to look at scope 3. I don't know, I haven't looked at the detail of it, but whether they were thinking they would just deal with scope 3 between 2030 and 2050 or what their actual strategy was. But I think it will really
because the reality is a fossil fuel based organization, or let's say a company that's a heavy user of natural resources, the reality is once you look at scope 3 emissions, the only way to reduce is to do something different.
Yeah.
So that requires moving out of fossil fuels, I guess, and into other industries, presumably renewables, which they are doing. All of the major fossil fuel companies are driving that forward at a rate. But ultimately, it's about changing tack completely in terms of the strategy of what the organization does. And I think the response of Shell was that they would do it at the pace that society changed, because obviously transition is a hugely complex issue. It's simply not as simple as turning off the wells and stopping oil production. That just can't happen. And recent events in Ukraine and so on have highlighted the dangers of that. So,
we've got that exact issue here at the moment with the passing of our so-called safeguard mechanism, which is about the biggest emitters having targets to legislated targets to reduce. And in order for the legislation to pass, the Greens in our parliament and the independents are wanting the government to require that no new coal be approved, no new gas projects be approved. And it's a real sticking point, because obviously as part of a transition, you still need some of the old sources to help buffer the system until you've got enough renewables, and also to balance out the peaks and the troughs with renewables. So it's a really interesting time in Australia at the moment on that exact point.
Well, I mean that's been the direction of travel in the UK, and it was until the Russians invaded Ukraine, and then suddenly energy security has jumped to the top of the political priority list. And maybe even in the space of 12 months, people are more accepting of the fact that transition has to be a genuine paced transition to allow us to actually cope with it. So it's the arguments are enormously complex, and it's going to rumble. So you asked about what the remedies would be. I mean, it's impossible for a court to tell the company what its environmental strategy should be.
They're not experts, are they?
They're experts in the law, but they're not experts in that. So it's going to be, the reality is this is going to run for quite a long time. Even if the litigants are successful, what does success look like? Success is probably going to look like telling them to go away and do it again.
Mm.
But then they're going to come back, rather like the UK government, with a lot more detail, a lot more qualitative assessments, maybe some faster targets, some more wide-ranging targets. But then those themselves will be subject to scrutiny, maybe challenge. It's going to run and run.
It is. And I think the other interesting thing, if it goes the way of the sort of the trend of the greenwashing cases, so all the environment groups that sort of brought those initial complaints, it then led to a regulator focus on greenwashing in Australia. So I've now got the ACCC and ASIC, our consumer and corporate regulators, really focused on it. So they're now bringing actions against companies for greenwashing. And I wonder whether it'll be the same, that the way that the environment groups are bringing these actions against directors and asking for more detail, whether the regulators are going to start doing that too.
Well, I mean, we're certainly seeing that across Europe, I think it's fair to say. And in the UK, we're seeing advertising standards legislation now being used. And we're seeing the regulator in the UK, the Financial Conduct Authority, we're seeing their own existing regulations around disclosure being used to attack. And for simple mis-selling. Misstatements in prospectuses being published, in publicly available documentation and disclosures, the kind of veracity of those disclosures is being challenged by using, again, laws that have been around for a long time. You know, the
misleading
basic rules
and deceptive conduct. Yeah,
absolutely. none of this is new. And I think there's a sense to which those wishing to challenge the existing position that companies have been taking have woken up to the fact that there's no point sitting around waiting for new legislation, some kind of new rule that is going to be shaped to the current world, that actually the toolkit is kind of out there for people to challenge. What was needed was the disclosure rules that forced companies to disclose in this area, in non-financial performance rather than financial performance. And now we're seeing that. And now we're seeing, certainly in the UK, we're seeing that being applied to a broader spectrum of companies. You can therefore expect more of these actions. And in fact, I mentioned there was a greenwashing case that I'd read in the last couple of days being brought against Shell. And that was around a specific disclosure that they had made around their investment in renewables. And there were questions, the litigation was being brought because it was suggested they simply haven't genuinely presented the position in terms of the percentage of their total investments over the last 12 months that have been made in renewables. Now, I've no idea whether that claim has any substance or not, but that claim is being brought under existing legislation and under rules that have been around for a long time. It's just, it's not something they would have ever had to disclose 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we've got a similar one that's just been lodged, or a complaint at this stage by the Environment Defenders Office in Australia. To the ACCC against Shell again. And that one is, again, using those disclosure sort of provisions to say, well, they've disclosed what they're doing, but that it's misleading because they're relying too heavily on offsets and because they're still investing in new projects and not transitioning. So again, sort of that using that disclosure legislation to sort of force a greater move towards transitioning.
But I think that the reality is, as you start to see these actions stacking up in courts in a number of different jurisdictions, obviously it's just putting more and more pressure on companies to respond rather than just defend the litigation. I think that there is almost a tsunami of pressure being brought to bear in various different jurisdictions, and you're seeing it in the European courts, in the European Court of Justice in terms of the EU, the International Court starting to look at whether governments have a basic obligation to protect their clients, to protect their citizens, from the risks of the climate crisis and the impact it has on their health and well-being. The more cases that are brought in, the more in more jurisdictions, you can see, is going to create this kind of almost body of jurisprudence that will put increasing amounts of pressure on companies, quite frankly, to just do more.
And I think the prudent director, you know, just has to learn from all of those cases and really start to get a bit more rigorous in the way that they're responding and and more sophisticated in the way that they're putting together their plans. There's been a really helpful opinion put out, or two different opinions over the last few years by some silks in Australia that really look at what, you know, what directors need to be doing in terms of having a, you know, reasonable basis for their transition plans and making sure that they've got a robust and, you know, well-documented process in place to be able to implement their duties of care with diligence.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're seeing, in the UK, I think in 2019, a Supreme Court judge gave a view as to the fact that the existing Companies Act legislation could well be argued that all directors should be taking climate risk into account in their policies on a day-to-day basis in any event. Again, that the law was already there that told them they had to do it, that they shouldn't be waiting for legislators to come up with something different. There is a movement in the UK to change the Companies Act to impose an explicit obligation in terms of impact on the planet and impact on society of companies' activities. But in the meantime, the argument is that actually the legislation is probably good enough. And I think the Shell case highlights the fact that the argument actually comes down to a financial one, which is the cost of doing nothing could be huge. The cost to shareholder value, you know, companies could become the next Kodak when faced with digital cameras coming in. And, you know, if you don't act quickly, you're kind of dead in the market.
Yeah.
And that's the risk that directors should be thinking about, irrespective of their personal views as to whether they should be acting or not acting. You know, there are wider questions around whether it is the role of business to be doing this or not.
I think that
gone.
Debate has passed. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Kind of almost done. And yeah. Certainly when I
talked
to
That's what we were talking
clients,
about a few years ago, but now it's well and truly passed.
Yeah, I talk to my fellow partners and I talk to clients and I talk to other people, it kind of doesn't matter whether you think that's right or not. This is just what's happening in the business world. It's happening. It's what's happening at a wider level in society. And as a director, you've got to listen to what's going on.
Well, Neil, I'm looking at the time, and we've chatted away for quite a while now, so we might wrap up. But that's been really fascinating. Thank you for joining us, and thanks everyone for listening today and throughout the year to our podcasts. As always, please get in touch with us if you have questions. You can find our details on our website, which is hallandwilcox.com.au, or the Mills and Reeves website, which is mills-reeve.com. Or you can connect with us on LinkedIn. If you've enjoyed today's episode, then please rate, review, and follow our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for joining us.